So our passage this evening is the one that I read earlier on, Proverbs chapter 19, 28, through to chapter 20, verse 11. Now this passage doesn't have the kind of intricate arrangement that last week's passage had. It doesn't tell a story like the passage before that did. It doesn't focus on a single vice like foolish speech, as a couple of recent passages have. This one doesn't go down any of those particular routes. But that doesn't mean that this passage is just a shapeless cobbling together of random proverbs. No, there's something definite and deliberate going on here. This passage has its own logic. And this evening then, I want us to trace that logic and to do so under two main headings. And first of all then, a sustained exposure. That's our first heading, a sustained exposure. There was a story in the news this past week about the Donmar Warehouse Theatre in London. And theatres then, as you know, have a general policy of warning audiences in advance if a play contains scenes of a violent or a sexual nature that might cause offence. The Donmar Warehouse, however, has taken that policy to a new level by warning audiences that in one scene a man is seen smoking, or that in another scene a woman is seen in a mildly inebriated condition, that kind of thing. And this has provoked a lot of response then, people saying the theatre is being way too sensitive and pandering to the snowflake generation. And maybe then I'm pandering to the snowflake generation, but I want to issue a warning about this passage this evening, and it's this. It contains material that is grim and uncomfortable. It contains a very bleak assessment of the human condition. It contains a sustained exposure of sin. Now, in the United Kingdom in 2019, sin is not a fashionable word. It's not a fashionable concept. But this passage is unflinching in its exposure of sin, and in particular then it highlights two things. First of all, sin's diversity. A couple who live opposite us recently offered to swap their wheelie bin with us, the reason being that theirs is slightly bigger than the normal size ones, and with us being a bigger family and with the bin collection dropping to once a fortnight, they thought we might appreciate the extra capacity. Now, I was surprised by this, not just because it was a very kind offer, but because I'd always imagined that wheelie bins only came in one type. The idea of them coming in different shapes and sizes was a bit mind-blowing for me. And it's easy then to view sin the way that I'd always viewed wheelie bins, to think that sin comes in one type, a type that conveniently is a million miles away from anything that I've ever done or am ever likely to do. But sin doesn't come in just one type. Sin is diverse, and this passage certainly doesn't attempt an exhaustive survey of all the different types of sin, but it does touch on three quite distinct types or categories of sin, and significantly with each successive category it kind of comes a little bit closer to home, we might say. So it touches on what I'm going to call subversive sin. So chapter 19 verse 28 and chapter 20 verse 10 both describe betrayals of trust, but betrayals of trust in big context. So I watched the tennis match on Thursday evening between Nadal and the Australian guy Nick Kyrgios, or Kyrgios, however you pronounce his name. He's kind of the current bad boy, as some of you will know, of the tennis world. And as well as arguing lots then with the umpires, this guy, one of the other things he occasionally does is he serves underarm. And when he serves underarm, he nearly always wins the point. The opponent is, of course, standing well back on the court, expecting and kind of 140-mile-an-hour rocket or something to come his way. Instead, he gets this tame little effort, and so it just drops over the net, and he can't get there in time to return it. And this trick, then, technically, it's not against the rules of tennis. It's just a betrayal of trust. It's discourteous. It's ungentlemanly conduct that this guy is getting up to. But at least it's only in the context of an ultimately inconsequential little game. These betrayals of trust, however, are in contexts where trust is vital for the maintenance of social order itself. So in chapter 19:28, it's in the judicial realm, where, of course, it's crucially necessary, isn't it, that witnesses can be relied upon to tell what they believe to be the truth. A witness in a court of law, of course, might be mistaken in his or her testimony. But when witnesses in courts of law deliberately mislead, and thus, as Solomon puts it there, mock at justice, that is an assault on the foundations on which civilized society stands. It's subversive. And then in chapter 20, verse 10, the betrayal of trust is in the commercial realm, where, of course, it's crucially necessary that sellers can be relied upon to be giving you what you paid for and what they are saying they are giving you. But the sellers here aren't doing that. The weights that they are using to measure out quantities have been deliberately tampered with. And again, then, it's an assault on the foundations on which civilized society stands. It's subversive. And we could doubtless think of other betrayals of trust at a similar high level. Doctors, on whom we must be able to rely for at least well-meaning medical help, deliberately harming or even killing patients. In recent times, charities, on which we must be able to rely to use our donations to bring aid to the needy, getting up to immoral activities in crisis-hit regions. So that's one category of sin, the really extreme stuff, what we might call subversive sin. But then the passage touches on what I'm going to call self-abandoned sin. Self-abandoned sin. Look at the behavior described in verses 1 and 3 of chapter 20. These are simple cases of self-control being completely absent. Self-control absent in one's alcohol intake, there in verse 1. And then self-control absent in one's social interactions, in verse 3, so that every provocation or irritation finds you getting into a massive argument. And I'm sure you can see then that in this category, self-abandoned sin, we are getting a little bit closer to home. I mean, the absence of self-control is hardly a niche issue, is it? It's not the preserve of especially depraved individuals. It's common, whether it's the inability to bite one's tongue and refrain from shouting at one's spouse when tired and stressed, or whether it's the inability to resist the pull of pornography when one is frustrated and desperate for a brief flight of escape from reality. Self-abandoned sin. And then the passage touches on what I'm going to call subtle sin. There are two examples of this. Laziness and insincerity. Laziness is described in verse 4, where we encounter yet again one of this book's staple characters, the sluggard. And laziness then is a subtle sin because, of course, it isn't what the lazy person is doing that's the problem. It's what the lazy person is not doing that's the problem. In this case, he's not getting out into the fields when it's time to plough, probably because it's autumn and it's not a terribly inviting time of year to be out there in the fields and to be putting in a hard shift. And notice, in fact, that having not ploughed in the autumn, there in verse 4, he still goes out and seeks at harvest. He still goes out to the field to look for crops at harvest, kind of creating this impression that the harvest should be there and it's just some mystifying freak of nature that it's not there, adding to the subtlety of this, that he's kind of not only being lazy but hiding the laziness by then going out and looking for crops once harvest time comes. And then the insincerity, that's described in verses 5 and 6. And of course, insincerity is in its very nature subtle, isn't it? Because you're appearing virtuous when you're not. In the case of verse 6, thereby proclaiming insistently your steadfast love. But your heart, verse 5, is a deep water, containing thoughts and plans that are much less noble and altruistic than these words, these impressive words of love that you're spouting out. And this category then, subtle sins, surely it comes closer to home still, doesn't it? Subtle sins like laziness and insincerity, where we can still maintain a facade of decency. At this point, you can perhaps see why I issued that warning that this material in the passage is calculated to cause discomfort. It's challenging, it's convicting, it makes us squirm. So sin then is not like wheelie bins, it's diverse. But one other thing, just before we're done with this sustained exposure of sin, we've seen sin's depravity, but let me just draw your attention to sin's distribution. Sin's distribution. Look at verse 11. And I want to suggest that we translate this verse a little differently to how it appears in the ESV. So something like this: even a child in his acts pretends or feigns. That verb, which the ESV translates makes himself known, it actually can have that opposite meaning: pretends, feigns. It's used in that way in 1 Kings 14, verses 5 and 6, where King Jeroboam's wife goes to see the prophet Ahijah to ask him what's going to happen to their son who is sick. And she is Jeroboam's wife. Jeroboam is a wicked king. She knows she can't just turn up as Jeroboam's wife, so she pretends to be someone else. And the verb pretend there in that passage is the same verb in the Hebrew that we have here. So even a child in his acts pretends or feigns. And you see, it comes straight after verse 10, where we have those wretched sellers, those tradesmen who are pretending that a bag of vegetables is heavier than it really is. But verse 11 then is saying it's not just wretched sellers, it's not just perverse tradesmen who pretend and feign. Kids do it too. They tell you they've washed their hands for dinner when they haven't really washed their hands for dinner. They tell you that it was the sibling that started the quarrel when really they know they started the quarrel. And so he ends with that, with what is in fact a question, I think, in the second half of verse 11. So even a child in his acts pretends, and then the question, so is his conduct pure and upright? Is the child's conduct pure and upright? Expecting the answer, no. And the point then is that sin is universal. Even little children who can't properly feed themselves or dress themselves or do lots of basic everyday things, they know how to sin. They don't need to be taught how to do that. And this universality of sin is probably in view also in the second half of verse 6, that question, a faithful man, who can find? And here then, this exposure of sin reaches its terrible climax. Sin is diverse. It can't be reduced to just things that other people do, very stereotyped categories of sin. And sin's distribution across the human race is total. And please then, if you've never reckoned with this reality before, this grim reality, I encourage you, I urge you to do so this evening. Christianity and the Bible contains no good news until first you have accepted the bad news of passages like this one, that the human race is in this terrible bondage. This bondage to this ugly reality the Bible calls sin. And so that's the first thing in our passage, a sustained exposure, this exposure of sin. But then notice with me, secondly, a solved enigma. A solved enigma. And the enigma to which I'm referring is this. Our passage points, as we've just seen, to this universal bondage that I mentioned just now. This universal bondage to sin. And yet, at the same time, there are hints in our passage that not all are bound in the grip of sin. Let me show you those hints. So we have in verse 3 of chapter 20, the reference there to a man who keeps aloof from strife. A man who does have this self-control that I talked about earlier, and who is able then to be provoked and to be irritated and yet not get dragged into a big argument. It's Old Testament's equivalent of what Paul talks about in Romans 12:18, about if possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. And Solomon there is depicting a person who is living peaceably, as far as it depends on him, with all. Remaining out of arguments, out of quarrels, out of strife. Then again, you go down to verse 5, and we have a reference in the second half of that verse to a man of understanding who can read the deep waters of a person's heart. I mentioned last Sunday evening that story that Ruth Graham told at her father Billy Graham's funeral. The story of how she had been divorced and then very quickly got involved in a romance with a man whom her parents didn't approve of, and they told her to slow down and not to get too involved, but she disregarded their advice. And the point I was making last Sunday was about how she then, the relationship, she got married, the relationship very quickly broke down, and she went home to her father, and her father, rather than scolding her, rebuking her, came out to meet her, and like the father Jesus talks about in Luke 15, welcomed her home so lavishly. A wonderful picture of the fatherhood of God there in Billy Graham's conduct toward his daughter. But let's just rewind the story a bit to that point then, where Billy Graham and his wife could see into the heart, almost we might say, of that man who would later prove to be so treacherous. And they could read that, and they could discern that. And there is a certain discernment then, isn't there, that comes with increasing holiness and increasing closeness to God. And that's what this is talking about, a man of understanding being able to discern when a person is being insincere, being able to read to some extent that person's heart, not be deceived, not be fooled, not be duped. The opposite of gullibility, that's what's been described in the second half of verse 5. Well, then you go down to verse 7, and we have this reference to the righteous who walks in his integrity. A very positive description. A wonderful touch, by the way, in the second half of the verse. Blessed are his children after him. And just as an aside there, we talked last Sunday evening about rearing children, about parenthood. And we looked at verse 18 of chapter 19, discipline your son. And we talked about that not just being about punitive stuff, correction, but being about a wider package of wisely raising your children. And we talked about the importance of that, but I think this is reminding us, this verse, verse 7 of chapter 20, that there's something more fundamental actually than even raising your children in a correct way, and that is just being righteous before your children. being righteous in the home, the thing that will most shape and affect your children is not so much child-rearing techniques that you administer on them, but it's just being righteous, being godly, being like Jesus in the home. That will leave a deeper impression. That will have a bigger impact than reading all the books on the shelves of the Christian bookshops about child-rearing and applying all the different techniques. Just being parents of integrity. Blessed are children who are raised in that context, Solomon says. But I'm kind of running ahead of myself there, because the real question then, the enigma that's posed by those three hints I've just pointed you to, is this. How, if sin is this universal bondage, if everyone is in the grip of it, how do we have here these hints of human beings who aren't, who are able to keep out of strife, who are people of understanding, who walk in integrity? How is that possible in a sin-diseased, sin-bound world? That's the enigma to which I'm referring. But my heading was a solved enigma. And the solution to the enigma then lies, it seems to me, in verse 9. And verse 9 then, at first sight, it looks like just another testimony, doesn't it, to the universality of sin. Who can say, I have made my heart pure, I am clean from my sin? It looks like just another expression of the reality that everyone is tainted by sin. But notice two things here. First of all, notice carefully what is said there. It doesn't say, who can say my heart is pure? It says, who can say I have made my heart pure? That's the issue. That's the point. And it's important then just to take note of that. And then notice, secondly, that this follows on from verse 8. And we haven't talked yet about verse 8. And verse 8 belongs to a pair of verses in our passage. Goes kind of with verse 2, both of which describe this king. And you read verse 2 then, the terror of a king is like the growling of a lion, whoever provokes him to anger forfeits his life. And that could just be talking about any king who is kind of fulfilling his judicial role that kings had in the ancient Near East. It could be talking about any Israelite king, and referring to his terror and his anger and his punishment of evildoers. Verse 2 could just be that. But verse 8 seems to go beyond any ordinary king, doesn't it? Because the king in verse 8, he winnows evil, we're told. That is, he gets rid of evil. Winnowing, it's an agricultural term. It refers to kind of getting rid of the chaff, the weeds, and separating it from the good crop and then getting rid of it. And so this king, he winnows evil. Well, okay, that's what kings were supposed to do. But this king, he winnows all evil. That's a pretty impressive statement. And then it says he winnows all evil with his eyes. Well, that's more impressive still. And surely then, as we've seen with some other king proverbs, surely here we are being pointed beyond Solomon and beyond any Israelite king and beyond any normal king in this world. Surely we are being pointed here, and we shouldn't be surprised, in an Old Testament that ultimately is about Jesus. Surely we've been pointed here to the King. The king, who you remember is described interestingly in Revelation chapter 1, John on the Isle of Patmos seeing that initial vision of Jesus. And it's such an impressive vision, isn't it? And do you remember one of the details that John observes in Jesus? Revelation chapter 1, verse 14. The hairs of his head were white like wool, like snow. His eyes were like flames of fire. His eyes, these burning things that can burn up evil. And that seems to be the kind of idea we have here in Proverbs 20, verse 8. This king who with his eyes burns up and destroys evil. I'm saying then that this verse, it's pointing us to Jesus. And to Jesus then, as the one who ultimately expels evil. And of course, Jesus expels evil at more than one level. So Jesus expels evil at the cosmic level, doesn't he? There's going to be a world one day free from evil altogether. He's going to come back from heaven, the Lord Jesus Christ, where now he's reigning. He's going to come back and he's going to drive all evil out of this world. We can't imagine, can we, this world and all the threads of evil have been disentangled from it, pulled out of it. And the world is pure and new. But that's what he's going to do. We've seen a little bit of this in the parables of Matthew 13. We've referred recently to John the Baptist, who talked about Jesus with his winnowing fork in his hand. Jesus is one day going to purify the world of evil so that, as Peter says, there will be a new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. So Jesus in the future is going to winnow all evil in that cosmic sense. But Jesus now in the present winnows evil in an individual sense. He comes into people's lives and he releases people from that bondage to sin we've talked about tonight. And he starts to drive out the evil from people's lives. And he starts to purify them and make people's hearts evil-free zones so that they can keep themselves from strife in the language of verse 3. And they can be men and women of understanding in the language of verse 5. And they can walk in integrity in the language of verse 7. This is part of what it means to be a Christian. It means that the Jesus who one day will rid the world of evil, he has already come into your life and has started to rid you of evil. It's a most beautiful and a wonderful thing. And it leads me then to close in this way tonight. That all of us, I talked this morning about there being two possibilities for all of us. And I'm going to talk tonight now about there being two possibilities for all of us. All of us participate in this winnowing of King Jesus, described in different places of the Bible and here in our verse. Either we are ultimately part of the evil that Jesus winnows. We live our lives remaining in that bondage to sin, remaining in the grip of sin. And we never change and we never turn from that. And when Jesus Christ comes, we will be part of the evil that he drives out of the world. And that's a terrifying prospect. We could be in that category. Or we're in the category of those who have come to Jesus Christ and made him our king and have bowed the knee to him, in which case we are the objects of his winnowing now, in the sense that he's driving the evil out of our lives and he's freeing us from it. And he's making us pure and he's making us lovely and he's making us new. We're in one of those two camps tonight. We're going to be part of the evil driven out by him, or already the evil is being driven out of us by him. Which category are you in tonight? This is tremendously serious. There's no greater question you can confront. Forget Wimbledon for a moment. Forget the leadership contest between Johnson and Hunt for a minute. Forget everything else for a minute. Just consider this question. Are you going to be winnowed by Jesus because you've never repented? Or are you repentant tonight and already the evil is being driven out of your life by this wonderful king? If you're in the first category, repent. Come. Come to Jesus. And say, Lord Jesus, King of my life, I crown you now. Amen.